Welcome back to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. Today we're talking about surrogacy. In the last half hour, we heard from a friend of mine here in our valley who is serving as a surrogate for a Montana couple she knows. Her motivation is altruistic, not commercial. But many intended parents not fortunate enough to know a woman like my friend turn to commercial surrogacy, including international surrogacy. During the next half hour, we'll be focusing on ethical issues related to international surrogacy as it is practiced today. Joining us now is Professor Michelle Goodwin. Professor Goodwin teaches at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. She's also the founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. And she's the author of more than 80 articles and essays and book chapters, as well as 5 books, including Baby Markets, Money and the New Politics of Creating Families. Professor Goodwin, could you start by kind of giving us an overview of the range of laws regulating surrogacy or not?
Well, that's a very short conversation then. The federal government has one law that is euphemistically called the success rates law. And that law requires that clinics that perform in vitro fertilization and other procedures identify what they would call the successes of those procedures. Now, it's important to think about what success means because it's not well defined. It only means that there was a pregnancy and birth that occurred. What's good about the law is that there's wonderful empirical data that's generated from this so that we're able to then track, well, how often do these procedures actually work, such as resulting in a pregnancy? And what we know is that they're very high failure rates, nearly 70% in the best case scenario will fail after one cycle, and normally then there are multiple other cycles. Beyond that, there's very limited regulation. There are some states that require that insurance providers provide an opportunity for families that are infertile to be able to use assisted reproductive technologies in order to become pregnant. But it really is what some might call a wild, wild west, meaning that people can engage in these systems however they so choose, really, given that there's very limited federal oversight domestically or abroad. And then each state regulates on its own.
So could you talk a little, it sounds as if in some states commercial surrogacy is legal, maybe not in others, but internationally, how are things regulated?
Well, that's also a very good question because the United States has actually been very slow to recognize the breadth that is legally. They know about it, Congress knows, but very slow to do very much in the area of international surrogacy. And I'd also say that what states would say is that they don't tolerate commercial surrogacy, but it's really a matter of lexicon, right? Because people do get paid in order to provide the services of their womb. And so where this becomes an issue internationally is that with very limited federal oversight, there are children being born abroad of American parents who are not then registered as United States citizens. And let me give you an example of this. Because the failure rates are so high, Americans who utilize surrogates abroad really want to make sure that a pregnancy occurs. And because of this, they'll be more inclined to support a physician abroad implanting multiple embryos, something that's frowned upon here. Well, multiple embryos can result then in multiple fetuses being gestated. If an American is contracted with a surrogate, though, that he or she only wants one child, then what can happen is that there might be multiple births if there hasn't been selective reduction. And if the American takes only one of those children back to the United States, how do we define the other kids that were left behind? There are countries that will not claim those kids as their citizens, meaning that there are stateless kids born to American parents abroad. And there are other legal issues that arise in this space too. Marriage equality is now the law of the land, thanks to the Obergefell decision and also the Windsor decision. But because of a very conservative administration now, frowning in some ways on LGBTQ couples, it means that there are couples that are married that have gone abroad to utilize assisted reproductive services, but have had difficulty returning their kids home, even though they happen to be married. And that is if one of the spouses happens to not be American. So, you know, it's a space where we really need more legal attention, more attention to ethics, and really more attention to equity and equality.
I had no idea that the failure rate was as high as it is. And so what happens if they implant multiple embryos? Could a woman end up carrying triplets, for example?
Oh, my goodness. Not only triplets, it could be quadruplets. So in this implanting of multiple embryos, what's also important to know is that generally, if the surrogate is an American, then likely she's been educated. There's a higher incidence of women who are military spouses who live on army bases where they have health care, guaranteed health care. That's the story in the United States. When surrogates are chosen abroad, it's not the same dynamic. Very often these women are coming from very marginal economic circumstances, many of whom happen to be illiterate. They're housed in compounds that look like dormitories, and in reality, these are far better than the circumstances from which they come. But they sign these contracts with an X or their thumbprint because they can't read. So there are women abroad, such as in India, who would agree to have multiple embryos implanted, agree to a process called selective reduction. Selective reduction is used if there have been multiple embryos implanted, or even if just one, but it results in the fetal gestation of three or four, then this woman with her thumbprint has agreed that her uterus can be selectively reduced of the multiple fetuses and left with just one. You know, it raises questions in ethics, for sure, and also in human rights. What some of these surrogates are subjected to. Now, there are those that say, well, look, these women have a far better life when they're doing this. They make a little bit of money. Often I should tell you that they don't make the money that they're promised, but they do make some money. And there are those who say they're better off than if they were just still in the slums of Bihar or some other part of India. But there are any number of tragedies that sometimes are associated with these practices abroad. And I could tell you just, you know, one other thing, too. HBO's Vice did a story on this, and I participated and was interviewed by them over a period of 2 years. And, you know, one other manifestation that results from this happens to be the selling of children. Now, the things that seem bizarre actually become real life. Now, the scale and scope of this, we don't know, but to the extent that there are extra babies left behind, if an American couple wants just one, and try to gamble a better outcome by implanting multiple embryos, well, then there, you know, it's not uncommon that at least twins end up gestating. Well, there's become an industry, small though it may be, of babies actually being sold. And you can see in the Vice clip that as the reporter is talking, the undercover reporter is talking with someone in that industry, she's just talking about, well, if I wanted to, could I purchase a baby? Lo and behold, right at that dinner, someone actually offers her the baby in her hand. So these are real issues.
You know, I actually saw that clip. I watched it twice, and I was astounded because I really had no idea that there were these sort of extra babies that you could just buy. My understanding is that there has been an attempt in India and perhaps other Asian countries as well to make it a little bit more regulated, a little bit sort of Wild West. What kind of success have activists been having?
Well, So I guess that's really a two-part question. What happens to be, what have people been doing on the ground? I think there's been tremendous attention that's been brought to these issues through HBO's Vice, through the work of various academics and also activists pointing out the inhumanity and inhumane treatment of many of these women. So this has resulted in some legal reform. But here, what I would caution is that legal reform on paper doesn't always result to legal reform on the ground. And that's the challenge. It's one of the challenges that persists in India, even with lawmakers who are committed to change. It doesn't always change. And I'll just give you an example. Some of my field research in India has also included forced underage marriage. In India, over the last 100 years, there have been at least six pieces of legislation that have been enacted that firmly opposes underage marriage, and yet it's a frequent problem that continues to persist in that country. So law on paper doesn't always result in law having an effect on the ground.
I agree with you, and I've been focusing on law in part because that's your specialty. But you're right. Passing a law doesn't necessarily mean that that changes the reality. So, I was going to close by asking you what kinds of laws you would like to see, but given the discussion we've just had about, laws are good but not enough, I guess I would ask, what would you want Americans to think about when they are considering international surrogacy? Do you think it's even something we should be considering? And if so, what should parents, intended parents, keep in mind?
So, I think at the front of the question is really a question about how we respect the humanity of others, such that we are not participating in a kind of neo-colonialism of the womb. And these are complicated matters, but I think it relates back to what we do in the United States and how we, handle our international relationships with other nations when we know that Americans will go abroad to outsource their demands for any given thing, whether it happens to be a womb, a kidney, a heart, a lung, or liver. The space of the biopolitic is that Americans are exporting their demands in across a myriad of spaces in the biological. And so one I think that's really important is that there are international level conversations about the consequences of how we are exporting this demand to other countries. We need to make sure that if these persist, and many people say that, international surrogacy should not persist, but if it does, one has to make sure that there are the appropriate measures in place to protect the people who happen to be involved. And first, that means the surrogate herself. And that is that she's well informed, that there is actual real informed consent that takes place, and that she actually is remunerated in the way in which she's promised to be remunerated. And I think that one would also want to pay attention to what happens after the fact to make sure that these women happen to not be exploited after they engage in these processes and even before. I'm somewhat reluctant to say that women should never be able to engage in this because for time of millennia, women have served as surrogate mothers in one way or another to others. I think really the important thing is to make sure that people are actually exercising clear choice when they are involved in these matters, and that the offspring are also protected too. I'm troubled by the fact that there are American children who are stateless abroad because they're not claimed by their American parents, not claimed by the U.S. Government, and not claimed by the countries that they happen to live in. And until these matters get better sorted out, then, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a call for a moratorium. And that could be advisable as a matter of pushing forward the kinds of changes that are necessary to make sure that the individuals who are involved are protected.
I very much appreciate your perspective on that. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Goodwin.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Today we're talking about surrogacy. When a friend of mine told me that she had decided to become a surrogate, I wanted to find out more about surrogacy, including commercial surrogacy. And as I have so many times in my life, I turned to Our Bodies Ourselves, or OBOS. My mother gave me my first copy of Our Bodies Ourselves in 1973 when I was 13 years old. Many women in my age group now tell me that Our Bodies Ourselves was like an institution for them, a revealing and trusted source of information. We could turn to Our Bodies Ourselves when we had questions about women's health and reproductive issues that we were afraid to ask anyone we knew. OBOS has gone through many changes since my mother gave me my first copy. The organization behind the books is still active, and one of the issues it's working on is global commercial surrogacy. When I reached out to Judy Norsegian, one of the founding members and current chair of OBOS, to get more information on surrogacy, she responded immediately. And we will indeed discuss the OBOS point of view and other perspectives on surrogacy. But I wanted to start by having a conversation about how this trusted source of information about women's health got started, how it evolved, and what it's doing today. So joining us now via Skype is Judy Norsegian. Welcome, Judy.
It's a pleasure to join you, Ninia.
Can you tell us how Our Bodies Ourselves got started?
Well, it's a very long and satisfying story, but very briefly, in May of 1969, at one of the very early women's liberation conferences held at Emmanuel College in Boston, interestingly, this is a Catholic women's school, there was a workshop held and coordinated by Nancy Miriam Hawley, who's one of the founders of Our Bodies Ourselves. And long story short, the group that met that day decided to continue to meet, first to pull together a good doctor's list in the Boston area, then realizing that they didn't really know what they needed to know to make these evaluative judgments. So they embarked upon a process of self-education. And it meant talking to nurses and the few physicians who weren't condescending and paternalistic. Interested in engaging with lay women in this way, and going to County Medical Library at Harvard Medical School and educating themselves as much as they could. And they continued to meet. They had some community courses. They understood that what they were learning in medical textbooks, which was very limited at that point, and had to be matched with what women's lived experiences were. And back then, we began to see that what was just as important as so-called facts, which, by the way, weren't always facts in those days, as physicians were led to believe, that these facts had to be married with the lived experiences of women, and that ultimately we were the best experts in our own bodies. And that was a wonderful beginning. It led to the December 1970 newsprint edition of Women and Their Bodies, which was retitled Our Bodies Ourselves in March of 1971, published by the New England Free Press. It was about 112 pages, and it sold for anywhere between 30 cents and 75 cents, depending upon the printing you're looking at. And word of mouth was enormous as a means of letting women know this information was there. And the only reason this booklet came out is that so many women wanted the mimeoed copies of the various topics that women had developed for the courses and the community. And they just figured, well, we've got to put this into a booklet so it'll be easier to distribute. 250,000 copies sold word of mouth, which is why the commercial publishers got interested. And it was the leading, the bestseller for the New England Free Press, which was a left, leaning movement publisher. And in fact, in the beginning, the men at the New England Free Press didn't think Our Bodies Ourselves was political enough to be published. But as we well know, the personal is political.
And the body is a very political place. Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Body Politic. I'm speaking with Judy Norsigian, a founding member of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Today's show is about surrogacy. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left, Judy, and I want to make sure we get to some of the points you all have been working on. Can you please talk about what OBOS is doing in terms of international or global commercial surrogacy?
Sure. We've been involved in this space for a number of years. The largest area of assisted reproductive technology has concerned us since the 80s, and we had that chapter in the 84 edition called New Reproductive Technologies. Well, they're not so new right now. And we've been looking very carefully at some of the serious risks to young women who undergo egg extraction, either to freeze eggs for their own future use or for fertility clinics where infertile women are seeking eggs to be used and to use these eggs to achieve their own parenthood goals. And we're also very concerned about the growing global commercial surrogacy industry. And one of the things that's happened very quickly is it's now multi-billion dollar. These involve both social and legal relationships. And one of the things we're very clear about now is that the intended parents are largely unaware of how these relationships are shaped by class and race, and that many gestational mothers don't have their rights respected and acknowledged, that we need to act now to ensure both equality for intended parents, but also for that we do not sacrifice the gestational mothers, the equity and justice that are fundamental to their human rights. So we've been working on a call to action for public health advocates, reproductive justice communities, and medical practitioners that is asking to endorse and to further these six principles. The first is that surrogacy providers must adhere to the recommended cap on embryo transfers. Many professional health and perinatal organizations now strongly urge capping transfers to one embryo per treatment cycle for any pregnancy using assisted reproductive technologies. And we explain why at our website if your listeners want to learn more. The second is that surrogacy providers must adopt vaginal birth as standard care. For a while in India, they were trying to pass legislation that would force the gestational mothers to undergo cesarean section as the mode of birth. This is bad for the gestational mother. It's also bad for the babies. It was just purely for convenience. So this really should be adopted as the standard care. And then, of course, if you need a cesarean, then you have a cesarean. Third, surrogacy providers must guarantee freedom of movement, access to community and agency in decisions. As some of us know from some of those talk shows and even Oprah Winfrey's show years ago, some of the gestational mothers in India were put in these maternity homes and they were not allowed to go out. They were not allowed freedom of movement. In fact, they were not allowed even the kind of exercise that would have produced better and healthier outcomes. Fourth, surrogacy providers must offer postpartum and longer-term support in recovery and adjustment. This is very, very important, especially for women whose health might have not been in the best shape when they went into these pregnancies. And we need to provide more attention to legal parentage and citizenship, information about genetic and birth parents, if mutually desired, physical contact possibly in some cases. We know now from a long history of working with adoptees that it's sometimes very important that the genetic parents, that the birth parents are able to be connected later on with their offspring, especially when the offspring come of legal age. Fifth, surrogacy providers must obtain informed consent. Plenty of evidence that these women who are gestational mothers do not provide informed consent. They don't understand fully what's in store for them, and this has to be the case. Sixth, surrogacy providers must consider looming questions and demonstrate steps towards solution. Given the complicated nature of these arrangements, and things have evolved very, very quickly, we have to think about the abandonment or abuse of children in the absence of checks and balances. We already see that happening. Their legal parentage as intended parents claim, but gestational mothers refuse to surrender parental rights, and their citizenship as countries from where intended parents originate refuse to grant travel documents. There's a legal quagmire here, as you might imagine, when everything doesn't go according to plan.
So we're going to be developing and refining this call to action in the next few weeks. It'll be at our website, the website of the Center for Genetics and Society, and hopefully we'll see the mainstream media paying attention to it as well.
That is tremendously helpful. So was there any debate within OBOS about whether to try to simply seek a ban on commercial surrogacy, or has the... Is it just more practical, more realistic to look toward regulation?
Well, we did feel that the cat was out of the bag, so to speak, and that it would be practically impossible to get a ban, partly because this does step on the toes of the reproductive freedom issues that we all care about as well. We didn't want to say, no, a woman couldn't do what she wanted to do with her body if she was, well, informed, she knew what she was doing. We felt that that was really important to recognize a woman's agency. At the same time, there are massive violations of human rights, just to put it bluntly. And so we think there needs to be heavy regulation and oversight so that these brokers in particular, the ones who are really without moral principle, they do not care about the ethics involved, and they will promote whatever practices will make them the most money. Those insidious players have to be stopped. So we don't take that position, nor did we ever want to take the position of trying to ban surrogacy, not just because it would be impossible to do, but also because we thought we could, with a really powerful call to action, get the kind of regulation in place that would accommodate everyone's needs.
Well, Judy, thank you so much. Could you just talk briefly about what you think is the future of our bodies ourselves?
Well, as you know, we've transitioned to a largely volunteer-driven organization. We have a terrific 6-member board, one of whom is from Colombia, Latin America. We are embarking upon a new agreement with Suffolk University, where the Center for Women's Health and Human Rights is partnering with us to create a new website that will create updated, evidence-based, women-centered information, much like you'd see in Our Bodies Ourselves, at this new website. It will be a partnership with us, but they will be administering it. They will be running it. The agreement really allows for the maximum oversight so that nothing untoward will come of this. We are very excited about that. That should launch within the next month or so. So even if we do not do another print edition of the book, although our partners in other countries are producing print editions, usually subsections of the book at first, and there'll be a book coming out in Montreal in French soon, one in France at the end of this year. Women in Morocco are working on something, possibly in Mongolia, and these tend to be both print and electronic. And so the work does continue, not just here, but in other places. And we see the web as the place to advance this consumer-centered, feminist-centered, women-centered information. And I know the word woman is very controversial at this point in time, but we're still using that term, particularly around pregnancy and birth at this point in our history. We are big supporters of the folks who did Trans Bodies, Trans Selves out of Philadelphia. In fact, Wendy Sanford wrote the afterword for this fabulous book, and if your listeners haven't seen it, they really should. It is modeled after Our Bodies, Ourselves. We were their inspiration, and I think they produced a book that was very much in the spirit of Our Bodies, Ourselves. So we're doing, I'm the chair of the board now. We are paying some consultants very part-time. We are still doing minimal fundraising, but short of a giant donation, which would bring in substantial funds, I don't see us in the near future hiring a new executive director and rehiring staff and getting back to the place where we were a few years ago. It's sad in some ways, but the fact that we're continuing to do important advocacy work, that we have so many people willing to volunteer, for example, with the Suffolk Project to help with the evidence-based information that will be coming up on that website, I think much of this work will be able to continue just in a different way.
Judy, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really thrilled to hear that OBOS will continue to be around. It's always been such an important resource for me. I know that people who want to support OBOS can go to the website to do that, as well as to get all the information that you have talked about. Judy Narcisian, thank you so much for being with us today. You've been listening to Body Politic.
My pleasure. Great to join you.